Well, hey guys, welcome to another Dad's Roundtable. I've got a few familiar dads around this table today. That's because this is part two of a conversation that we started, or actually a dialogue that we started about God's design for sex and how dads should have conversations with their kids about sex and sexuality. So I'm not going to do introductions again, but let's just go around the table really quick. Daniel Rankin, pastor of Student Ministries, OKC location.
Yep.
Scott Conrad, licensed marriage and family therapist here on staff at Crossings. And Ron Mon, licensed marriage and family therapist and professional counselor on staff at our Life Care Ministries. Thank you guys for coming back for part two of this very important conversation. I got a lot of good feedback about our part one, and I know we left a lot on the table that we wanted to talk about. So I'm hoping we can pick up where we left off and talk about why dads should be involved in these conversations. So let me just throw it out there. Why is it important for dads to be ready to engage on this topic of sex and sexuality with their kids? Why is dad an important figure in those conversations?
I think we may have talked about last time that it's an ongoing conversation with them. And so, you know, I have two boys that are 15 and 17, and so they are right in the prime of that time to be interested in girls and families and having a family of their own someday. So I think it is a conversation that needs to be had because of the culture that we live in.
As I think of that question, why are dads important in this conversation? I think dads have something to say here that kids need to hear. Dads have their own experiences and thoughts and expectations. I think dads have something to add to the conversation that their kids need to know.
Yeah. So. And there's a lot of things in parenting and raising up kids that I, just reflecting my own experience, I have a 10-year-old and a 7-year-old. I'll just defer. So things like pediatricians. Mm-hmm. My wife sets up those appointments with a dentist. Even school functions, she knows the school calendar better than I do. And there's some things I just kind of offload. I said, well, that's mom. She's got it. She's better at it than I am anyway. And I wonder if these kind of conversations fall into that category for some dads as well. It's sensitive, it's emotional, especially with maybe preteen or teenagers where it can get emotional about this topic and dad may fly off the handle. So I'm just gonna let mom handle it. So, but I think to your point, when dad steps in, there's a level of responsibility and accountability. Oh, he's not passive in this. He's safe to talk to about this topic. So that's, what are your thoughts, Ron?
My mind goes to the biblical example. In ancient Israel, the father taught the son things of faith and led in that way. And I think that biblical example of ancient Israel really speaks to a core truth that when dad says something, it lands differently than when mom says something. And it isn't that the dad is saying something better or that the dad is empowered in a way that mom isn't. It's different. Mm-hmm. And so understanding that example and the responsibility and accountability that it sets forth, I think it helps dads understand their accountability, their giftedness by God in the grand design of how they're to speak into their kids. The other thought that I have is we tend to parent out of anxiety, and dad's anxiety probably spikes, and it's easy to offload or defer because our culturalization is, and maybe even our physiology says we're not sensitive, like our wives are sensitive. And so I think we tend to parent in the direction of our anxiety.
Yeah.
And so this is a counter to that because I think it's true. Most of us are not comfortable with the theme of sex that may come out of it overwhelms me or it comes out of my own history that says, man, I didn't do it well and I don't want to get called on the carpet by my kids in some way. I think we need to be aware of ourselves. I think that's where everything starts. What's my awareness? But man, we have such a responsibility and such a gifting to step into our kids' formation around their own sense of gender, sexuality, and how we do that relationally, dynamically as we develop.
Yeah.
And I think somebody's going to do that for us if we don't do it.
That's true.
And so I think, you know, I look at the social media. I know it's not technology today we're talking about, but I always tell parents, I don't think we would drop our kids off if these platforms were brick and mortar. Like, hey, go into Snapchat. Hey, go into TikTok and just learn all you want.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I think it's my role to step up. And I love that word passivity. I don't want to be passive. And I think I can be passive when my wife is a strong woman and she would take that role if I don't. And so I appreciate you doing these.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I love that visual. Oh, yeah. If TikTok was a brick and mortar, you don't know who's in the lobby today. You don't know what they're playing on the screens in there. You don't know what the product of the day is. That's a good way to think about it. I like that. And with formation in mind, and as they're being formed, let's talk about the way that the brain functions at a young age. And as they grow from maybe, let's start with my kids, you know, 7 and 10 to preteen to teenagers, maybe high school graduating. What's the brain doing in those moments? If they're exposed to TikTok and maybe images and things that are going on.
You got to back it up.
Back it up even more?
Four. Yeah.
Four? Okay.
4 to 6 is the first gender identification phase, mm-hmm. In which male child moves after male parent, female child moves after female parent, or I'm using the parent, the dominant role model that is in their life, because it may be a single parent home in which there isn't the presence of same gender parent. But that starts in gender identification in our understanding of our own sexuality. And so if we back it up to 4, and what are they being exposed to? And in our culture, if they're watching the evening news, they're exposed, and they may not be watching it, but it's on in the background. Yeah. We are a highly sexualized culture, brashly so, and not always sensitive to the little ears that are around us. So I think start early in understanding their developmental process.
Because what they're exposed to is going to have long-term
Absolutely.
Effects.
Absolutely.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit. I was talking to some dads the other day with some preteens who are interested in starting the dating process. They have some, if he has, you know, a daughter with maybe some boys that are interested in her, and she's thinking about maybe what it looks like to date at a young age, which sparked a question and a great conversation that he and I had. What are y'all's thoughts on arranged marriages? Because I'm thinking there might be some credibility.
It depends on the dowry. Because all arranged marriages come with
how many goats
bride
do I have
price.
Already?
What do you bring to the table?
Yeah, but thoughts on dating. I mean, this you mentioned something in part one, how the process of maturity that young girls go through is getting earlier and earlier.
That's right.
As decades go on.
Right.
So it seems like these things are coming up earlier than what I recall being in middle school or even late elementary school of having an interest in a boyfriend or a girlfriend. So thoughts on, that's just open range topic.
Mm. You know, working in high school ministry, I see a lot of dating. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that comes to mind for me is dating can be a thing that is good in the lives of a kid or a student. I think sometimes whenever we talk about this, it's all about, you know, the dangers and the what not to do's, the things to look out for. And I know we're going to talk about those things, but I've also seen, when done well, this be a thing that is good in the lives of kids, that it's almost like a form of discipleship, mm-hmm. Right? That they spend so much time with this person and they, you know, iron sharpens iron. It can be that sort of experience in the lives of high school kids. So the one thing I would say just as we start is like be careful as a parent not to demonize it, not to make it something that you know is an evil in and of itself. It can be something in the life of your kid that God uses for good, that you and them, that it deepens your relationship, that it teaches them something about themselves, about how they experience other people. It can be a good thing. Mm-hmm. It can also go really wrong, and does sometimes. But I want to start with just that idea that it can be a gift to you and to your kid before we go into all of the things to be concerned about.
Well, and then let's developmentally, if you're using the model that we operate out of in life care, the second gender identification phase is in prepubescence and pubescence. So they're going to be, I mean, their bodies are coming online, but socially in our culture, they are also coming online in relationships. And that second gender identification phase, when we are a culture of such gender confusion, such sexual confusion, that it is important that we engage them in prepubescence and pubescence in the dynamics of the opposite sex. I don't, Scott, you may, you're closer to that.
Yeah, I think for me and my boys that to proceed with caution. Mm-hmm. I like that we don't demonize it. I am pretty strict on younger kids dating, like at 13, I just don't think they're ready. I think hearts can be hurt. And so, but as my boys have gotten older, I see their desire to marry. And so how do we build that plan? And how do you steward that process in the waiting period? What can you do to prepare yourself to be ready? And so,
I think too, it's important to define within the family, what do we mean by dating?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, is that hanging on Wednesday night with a particular girl in the group? Is that a date? They're talking to each other. Is that the, right. the current?
That is, yeah.
Yeah. You know, they're talking. And so is that dating? Is dating the two of them going to the mall by themselves to a movie? So I think it's important that we understand with them what these phrases, these catch-all, these categories of relational dynamic and intimacy, emotionally and spiritually and physically, what does that, what constitutes that? And so that's a good place for, you, I think, mom and dad to get really clear on. Yeah. What does it mean today? Jump in.
Yeah, and you mentioned things that are very like in real life, but most of the time I think what I observe is that it doesn't start in real life for most of these students. It's mostly online.
Oh, okay. So they're interacting, texting.
Yes. I mean, the beginnings of a relationship or dating, or sometimes not even the beginnings, but the whole relationship is something that plays out on a phone or virtually. And so I think even that, like the conversations you need to have with your kid around all sorts of relational dynamics, not just what happens in real life, but also what they do. What they do on their phones is really important. So,
and I talked to our boys about guarding your heart, and that means you're going to guard the heart of the person you're looking at too. And so, but I try to put myself back in that 14, 15-year-old boy body that, hey, I just like that girl because she was cute, and I hope she talks to me. So I try to back it up a little bit and understand that that's the process they're going through.
Right.
That rejection hurts, you know, and, you know, it's hard to put yourself out there, but to be ready when that does come. And I think they gain more confidence when they do have a plan and see the other person's heart, not just their own heart, for what they can get out of it.
And that conversation makes more sense. We talk about the job or the description of dad is to set the spiritual climate. And as you're setting the spiritual climate in the home, when those conversations come up, and that topic comes up, it just fits in the climate that you've already set. It's not out of the blue. It's not out of left field. What do you mean? Why should I consider somebody's heart? What are you talking about? It should be part of a greater dialogue that we're already having about life and spirituality anyway, right? So that should flow more naturally, I guess, ideally.
Right.
But as you say, Ron, not all dads are created equal in the way that we roll through these things.
No, we're not. And
we'll have different strengths.
And we hope that, I think that's why we're having this roundtable.
That's right, yeah.
You know, so that dads can step back and reflect where am I really functioning here? And what do I need to maybe engage in conversation and challenge within myself?
Mm-hmm. What kind of boundaries with dating should a dad put on restrictions of use of the cell phone, like late at night? Should a dad be kind of flexing on boundaries per the kid's responsibility or maybe maturity? What are your thoughts on, because as Daniel's pointed out, it's more of the online connections that happen first, which may be some dangerous things that could happen there through texting and Snapchat and TikTok and all that stuff. How should dad navigate those things with freedom and restrictions?
I like the guardrail analogy that Andy Stanley talks about. I think that's important to have those guardrails in place, not necessarily to think that they're going to do something wrong, but it's also something they can bump up against to kind of trigger, hey, maybe I don't need to go this far into this. And so since I'm paying their phone bill, I still have access to who they're talking to and what they can see and do on their phone. But hopefully training that heart that they have enough self-control to take that over when they pay their own phone bill and can do whatever they want with technology. And so I think it's a guardrail issue for me. What does that look like? How far you go? I don't know.
You know, I bump into this a lot talking with parents concerned about their privacy. And privacy is a privilege. It's not an entitlement. And it is a privilege that takes stewarding. And so I don't assume, and I don't want to raise them to assume, that their privacy shapes how I parent. And I see that a lot in parents who are working with this particular issue and their phone. I don't want to intrude into their phone conversation, and I just kind of go, well, you know, because that's a learning to manage privacy is a process. And to me, an 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old, it's a privilege, and it's easily withdrawn, and it's not unlimited, that there is limits to your privacy. And occasionally, I may do a spot check, or I may check your phone every, you know. Yeah. So just depending on their development emotionally and morally, their moral conscience is going to probably shape how I manage social media, texting, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I totally agree, Ron. I think one of the things that's really important about that process is the upfrontness, the clarity on the front end. Whenever you hand them a device, these are the expectations. This is how we expect you to conduct yourself. This is how we're going to be involved. Yeah, I think the clarity on the front end makes all of that less of an issue than just giving them something free rein and then having to go backwards and trying to undo what's been done. That can be really challenging.
And so it's going to be important in those conversations to say, these are our values. These are our operating values, not necessarily Susie's or Johnny's operating values of their family of origin. This is ours, and this is how it will be conducted. And I'm sorry. It's regrettable you don't like that.
Yeah.
I never say I'm sorry. Yeah. It's regrettable. Yeah, it's I can regret all
like
sorts
that.
Of things,
yeah.
But I'm not sorry. Give me the phone.
Well, I think it goes back to that protection. We're actually going into that building of TikTok and Snapchat and saying, hey, I'm not going to let you take over my kid. I'm going to protect him. And I have to be careful how I say this. We may cut this out. But my 15-year-old, I was so proud of him. He said, Dad, what does 69 mean? And I was like, wow, okay. And so I had to step back and not act alarmed, but say, hey, I'm so glad that you brought that up because this is what we're talking about. We need to discuss these things. So I kind of gave him the short narrative of what that meant in slang terms. But hey, you know, those things come up that my son is homeschooled, but he's active in youth. He's active in this co-op. And we try to protect him, but hey, there you go.
Yeah.
Cool. You know, that reminds me of a principle. I don't know if it's a principle. And that is the stewarding of their innocence. And we can wrap them in bubble wrap and stick them in a bubble. And I don't think that's good stewarding their innocence. On the other hand, their exposure to at 15 to the concept of 69, okay, whether you wanted it or not, now his innocence is reduced or retracted that much. And I think that that is often anxiety provoking. So, taking a pause sounds like a good thought so that I don't come across out of anxiety in a way that I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
Or because of my anxiety, I ignore it. And say, you know, go ask your mom. Yeah. That's awkward.
or lash out to, who did you hear that from?
Yeah,
we're going to shut that down.
Yeah, that shuts it down real quick. Right. And they know this is something, you know, it puts it in a red frame.
Yeah. I'd go back to the fact that he asked you and didn't Google that.
Yes.
Right? Like, there's been something that's been sweet. Set up there.
That's a good point.
About, you know, the way that you guys have initiated conversations with him, the culture you've created around these things that has allowed you to be a place that he asks those questions.
A source of information that I've trusted.
Yeah.
And not going to open up a whole box of things that you don't want him. That's a great, great point. Yeah. All right, let's progress in age a little bit. Let's say you have a teenager, young adult who is ready to start dating. How does dad navigate that? Let's say a dad with a daughter, she's interested in a guy coming over. My approach is, correct me if I'm wrong, I got the 12 gauge out and I'm cleaning it when he shows up. Ron, is that healthy?
No, you need to have a 12 page dossier that they have to fill out.
Okay.
And it's turned in and then it's got a 3-month wait.
Yeah. Is the background
and
check?
And then we'll talk about it. It includes a background check on the family. What do you mean? I guess. So it's, again, this is managing their development from innocence into awareness. And I need to think that clearly through. The one thing that I notice often working with families, mom and dad are not on the same page.
In the approach to dating and how?
So now you've got a crevasse that everything can fall into.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe you are of different mindset about how this should happen, but that's a conversation that is essential and that you guys are operating on the same page, because if you're not, there's going to, you know, that's a hole that they're going to shoot right through by and large.
I've got nothing off the top of my head.
All right.
I think my question, there is, so are you saying then step one is getting on the same page with your spouse?
And that should have happened, you know, like,
yes,
not when, you know, and what are the, again, you got to define terms. What is a date? And what are the parameters? What is the accountability in the way of chaperone or other, you know, do you have a sense of the kid's family? Do you have a sense that the values are somewhat aligned? Is this a group activity? Are they asking to split off? My sense is you always start in group. And when we see sufficient maturity socially and we have the full background check, then we'll start talking about pairing off. But even that's going to have a certain amount of accountability. It's a step-in process because development is a step-by-step process. Mm-hmm. So there are light switch moments when all of a sudden, you know, they were here and now they're here developmentally and in their interest. But I'm ultimately responsible. I may not control it, but I'm in charge. And so I want to take my position of being in charge and pace that sufficiently and with wisdom to the kid. And what my number one kid does is not necessarily what my number two kid does. Kids are not equal. They're individual. And so I parent out of equal. Now, that's a setup.
Yeah.
And we own that up front. We're going to approach each of you individually. Your bedtimes are not the same if there's a large spread age-wise. The older kid's going to go to bed. We did that last night. We kept the grandsons. And the six-year-old is allowed to stay 30 minutes beyond the four-year-old. And so that's an example that's been put in motion with reason given to both of them. I think dating is the same way. I'm throwing a lot out here. I don't know.
That's helpful.
Yeah. I just think that sometimes dating teaches you more about how to end a relationship than how to keep a relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen that, that kids have gotten hurt. But I think I want my boys to have that group setting with girls, but also I'm concerned that all of a sudden, I don't know if you see this in youth, that once they start dating, they kind of start isolating themselves from everybody else. And I think that can be a guardrail to be careful of.
Yeah.
You know, and then having people speak into that, like, hey, let's check in with your people that know you, older people that can kind of mentor that relationship, because, you know, your arousal template is going to take over. And if you're alone with a girl, things are going to escalate. And so I tell my boys that. I mean, that's how God designs our bodies. And we look forward to that. But
arousal template.
Yeah.
Let's double click on that. Arousal, what do you mean arousal template?
Okay, so what I mean by that, is that in your child's development, mm-hmm. that we're being, our sexual arousal template is being developed as we grow through the culture, what we see, what we hear, what Ron talked about on TV. And so what I see in my area that I work in is helping people overcome pornography is that they have an extreme high arousal template that's been messed with. And so therefore, it's not a healthy arousal template. And so you have young men that are going into relationships with very unhealthy arousal templates, their sexual drive,
right.
their sexual interest. And that's what I mean by that.
Yeah. What's the age nowadays of initial first exposure to porn or pornography?
Yeah, I'm hearing guys tell me they're 8,
wow.
12, 13, yeah.
Okay. What does that do? Help me with the word, Ron. Neuroplasticity. Yeah, the ruts and the things that it does to a young brain.
So in prepubescence and pubescence, you've got brain expansion. It's growing. Mm-hmm. And its circuitry is expanding. And so you're training that circuitry to understand the categories within the world in certain ways. So if we take the arousal template and we start stimulating it beyond the social ability. So we're just talking on a physiological.
Yeah.
So we're regressed emotionally. We're regressed socially. We're, you know, very concrete function in our morality, but we are stimulating the physicality and the sexuality of that brain beyond its capacity. And that's what we're seeing. And so it then indelibly, much like the, you know, the baby duck, it has an imprinting of normalizing this level of stimulation. It becomes the norm, and that arousals way up here. Mm-hmm. And then if I take image and then add some sort of physical experience with that, so, you know, and as we look at pornography, at first it's probably arousal, but pornography is always conjoined with masturbation, which is a physiological, emotional, tactile reinforcement. And so we're to use the word masturbation, to talk about masturbation is pretty taboo in some circles, particularly in evangelical faith, but it is never separate. I don't look at porn. Mm-hmm. Not get aroused, and then my body is yearning to do some things with that.
Yeah.
So we need to talk about the arousal template in the sense of pornography and masturbation.
Yeah. Starting at 8, if that comes.
Well, I don't know if 8, but
certainly
I think
by 11 for males.
Yeah.
And you know, girls are not outside of this.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of sexting. There's a lot of early, premature, precocious exposure physiologically, mm-hmm. to sexual stimuli in the culture. It's on the news. It's on commercials. I mean, look what we advertise now.
I like what you said, Daniel, not to demonize everything. So I don't want people to hear that this is something bad.
Yeah.
This is God's design of good and beauty, what James Brian Smith, you know, I love his, you know, that when it's designed and used in a good way, I tell my boys, this is what's going to attract you to your spouse, that you find something attractive in her, and that's how God designed you. But if you mess with that arousal plate, that development that naturally is going to happen, then it could affect that ability for you to meet someone that you really fall in love with and find them attractive and fun. So I want you to hear that's a good thing, that how you steward that arousal plate.
It's in the original design of stewarding an arousal plate or template. In Genesis 2, they were one flesh, married, naked, they're intimate, and no shame. Then all of a sudden, culture flips it all around. They are naked, they have sexual intimacy, they bring a lot of shame into marriage. And there does seem to be a template that God put into place of intimacy is good, it's healthy, it's appropriate in that context of marriage, then intimate. And there's a lot of freedom in that. There's no shame that you bring into that type of relationship. Is that a way to introduce God's design to sex with teenage, young adult?
Yes, and what I tell my boys that I can almost predict this, I'm good at this one, is that our enemy will design everything for us to get in bed with our girlfriend. Everything to drive us towards that bed. But once we get married, he will do everything he can to keep you out of that marriage bed. And you can ask any newlywed young man, if they're going to be honest with you, it happens.
Yeah.
And so you have to be a student of your spouse, and that's where you have to be, understand how to develop intimacy.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, pornography is an intimacy disorder. You don't know how to have intimacy.
The emotional, you mean the emotional and social aspects of that template have not been fostered when that intimate moment comes up. I don't know what to do.
Right. I don't know how to be intimate.
I don't, because the social and emotional hasn't been engaged.
Well, it's not just that too. You know, like I want to go back. I don't know how to keep the balance and the positive of this. This is God's beauty, but we are in a crisis culturally. Mm-hmm. And everybody in this society is impacted by this cultural shift. So I appreciate, you know, you keep pulling back to the beauty of this thing, but as therapists, we're stuck in the pathology.
Right, right.
But what happens when you expose early, you expose in large ways, you shape the arousal cycle, which ends in ejaculation. And so if I am quick, one and done, I don't have, you know, good intimacy, physical intimacy with our spouse is work. It takes time for both to hit those points for mutual satisfaction. If we early on are exposing our kids to pornography, and that teaches a lack of self-absorption, a lack of pace, an idealized sense of what this arousal cycle is like, then we shape the brain to be impatient with anything that's going to delay us. And so we get frustrated with foreplay, which is really, you know, it's paced, right? But if I have sexual image on demand and I'm in full peak physiologically, so I'm looking for release quickly, I shape then my expectations of how sex should go, but I'm also training my body as how sex should go.
Yeah.
And so I get really frustrated pretty quickly. So sexual frustration occurs as a result of easy access to sexual stimulation and sexual release.
Let's pause right there for a second. So in part one, we talked about dad is only going to lead his kids as well as he leads himself in that area. Okay, so let's pause for a second and let's say dad has some recovery to do with some baggage and history of that instant gratification found online through porn. What can dads do to start filling in those ruts, those neurological ruts that we just slide into because of that instant gratification and quick release? How can we start filling in those ruts? What are some, how would you counsel through that?
For me, I found a great program that's called Freedom Fight.
Yeah.
And it kind of takes all the taboo out of the words like masturbation that you don't want to talk about or things, but it does give you a sense of the biology behind it and how our brains get connected to that and addicted to that process, but also how we can build new pathways through the spiritual foundation of focusing on scripture. But once these guys learn what's happening in their brains, they kind of go, oh. And that's why I tell them, it's like there's a difference between your brain and your mind. So your mind is going to have to start working to build those new ruts, those new healthy pathways. Because I tell them, if you have a strawberry shake and broccoli, my brain is going to choose strawberry shake all the time. My mind's like, you know what? You probably should eat the broccoli today. Maybe have a little bit of the strawberry shake. So the mind comes into play of how do we steward our sexuality. And it doesn't mean that we are afraid to bring our boys alongside this, because my fear is if I don't teach my boys how to handle this, then they're going to be in the same trap that everybody else is.
So let's talk about that. Let's say a preteen or teenage son comes to dad and says, okay, I've found porn. Here's what I've been doing. You didn't know about it. Confession. Dad's been working on his self. He knows some ways to navigate that conversation, or maybe he doesn't. How would y'all counsel dad in that moment of stewarding a conversation of redemption for a young boy who maybe has fallen into a trap?
I think you should weigh in on this.
I mean, I think first off, again, You know, it goes back to what you said whenever you were talking about the question that you got from your son, the like stepping back for a moment, that anxiety, letting that pass. There's probably initially a shock or maybe even an anger that may come with that or some sort of emotion that I think if you can do your best to let that pass and understand the gravity of the fact that your son came to you to open that conversation, I think what a blessing.
Yeah.
That they're coming to you with confession. Again, as I think about the redemption that's there, we've heard all sorts of analogies around things that people have used to talk about, you know, whenever someone has had sex and, you know, it's like a flower that's crumpled, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And I think it's maybe Matt Chandler that's, you know, they say, who would want that? And Matt Chandler's like, well, Jesus wants that.
Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful moment in the life with you and your student, your child. One of the things that can happen whenever someone has already engaged in sexual activity or pornography or something is there's this feeling of like, well, I've already done it. Mm-hmm. You know, why should I stop? So I think it's important to talk to your kids about integrity, about that idea of, you know, it's not about purity maybe at that point, but it is about living in an integrated life. And so how do you move forward from there in a way that, you know, is integrated? So,
what occurred to me as you were speaking, I spoke a little bit a while ago about stewarding innocence. Mm-hmm. And confession is a way of restoration of innocence. And that innocence isn't not knowing or not have done, but the attitude with which I go forward in managing the theme of sexuality. And how I have a choice at that point of restoration of innocence. Am I going to hold self-contempt, you know, beating myself up for where I sinned, where I misstep, where I'm broken, or am I going to move forward in God's grace? And that God's love, you know, I'm thinking about this. Parents should move toward sexual understanding and development with God's love. That is wanting the very best for us. His goodness is in that innocence, not in not knowing, but the attitude with which I handle these kind of themes. And God is always pursuing us in helping us to expand understanding, and that includes knowledge and the challenge and accountability of handling those moments. Fathers who have history, mothers who have history that they are ashamed of, that they don't want their kids to know. And I'm going, that's probably true, TMI, right?
Yeah.
But how have you seen your innocence restored around these themes? How have you been released from self-contempt, guilt, shame? How have you allowed God's love to pursue you in these things that you regret? So that you may teach God's love to your tween, well, your child, right? But particularly as they're coming online with their maturation of both physicality, sexuality, emotional, spiritual, moral development, how does God's pursuing love allow us opportunity to approach this whole theme from a different perspective? Not of, oh, crap, right? I said that word, crap.
Right.
But, oh, man. You know, I've heard people that celebrate a girl's first menstrual cycle as a movement toward womanhood, taking 13-year-olds out and kind of doing a bar mitzvah or such among the men, right? Kind of that tribal honoring of his emerging sexuality and thus mature masculinity, even as we would want to celebrate a young lady's emerging femininity. That's positive.
Right.
It's biblical. And more than important, it teaches God's pursuing love, the Father's love. How did God teach his son sexuality? That's a stretch. Okay. We won't get into Trinitarian understanding, right? But, can we imagine what that might be like? How did the Father and the Son communicate and understand and appreciate the process of realization? You know, it, yeah.
Well, I think you said one word that is a word in our group is accountability. But that's a word you got to look at carefully, because I hear a lot of times, especially from my younger guys in their 20s, 28, yeah, I got an accountability partner. I confess, and we just confess to each other. Nothing happens.
Yeah.
And so I think back to your question, what can dad do for the son is, how do we have that accountability with each other? And I really think it goes to an older gentleman who can be more of that leadership, where it's just not like, hey, I'm going to confess to you. We confessed, but there's no growth.
Right.
And I'd love to discuss that with you guys, what you think about the accountability aspect for men, what you see.
Yeah, if you're both drinking the strawberry shortcake or the smoothie or whatever, you know, and oh, you had one today. Oh, I did too. You know, I use the Oreo analogy because I can eat a sleeve of Oreos, and it's not about eating the Oreos. It's about what's much more healthier and good and pure and true and holy that is worth pursuing. Let's pursue that together. Then we confess about eating way too many Oreos as it comes, but we're not going to focus solely on that. We're going to focus on what's much, much better. You were talking about pursuit of integrity and purity. And if our goal is to pursue those things and to live towards God's holiness, you know, if the kid that says, okay, I want to date, how far can I go? How far can I, what can I look at? What can I not look at? That's not the right question. The question should be, how holy can I be? Maybe if we're looking for integrity and purity. Thoughts on that? Should I restate that?
I've always heard the analogy of like, you've considering who you have on board, right? It's like, this is an old analogy, but I think I'm going to use it. It's like you're, a king trying to find a chariot driver. And, there's a cliff and the chariot driver's trying to show how good they are. They keep getting closer and closer to the edge. And then one just stays really far from the edge. And they're like, why'd you do that? Well, he's like, why would I get so close to the edge if I'm carrying the king on board, right? Mm. So, again, I think that's probably been told 100 times. But the idea—
I never heard that one.
Really?
No.
I mean—
But yeah. I'm an older generation, right?
So. The idea being, like, consider whose you are and who's on board whenever you're asking that question of how close I can get. How close should you get as a child of God? Maybe it has an impact. Sorry, you were talking about accountability, and I had a connection back to, you were talking about dating earlier, and you said as a parent, being able to talk to the people who see your kid in other arenas, whenever they're, are they isolating, things like that. And I think you hit on something that's really important there as a parent in any situation, but especially dating situations, is having those relationships with other important adults in your kid's life to be able to have conversations about what's going on in your kid's life in other arenas. Important relationships you might want to have are with a coach or with a, small group leader at church, with a teacher. Because I think we only see a piece of the pie as parents. And if we can have good, healthy relationships with those other people that are involved in our kids' lives, we get a bit fuller of the picture. So I even go back to that question about accountability. There's a chance that they're talking to somebody else about some of those things. And if you don't have a relationship with a trusted small group leader or with a trusted coach or with someone else who's involved in your kid's life in that way, then you might be missing out on some real key information that is available to you. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's huge because you have your community to work with, and they show, I think there's a study that shows that, kids are more likely to stay engaged in church and follow Christ after they leave home if they have another adult that is speaking into their lives besides family. It's good to have a family dinner, but also to have that small group leader that's telling them the same thing and looking after their hearts too. So it takes all of us to make that happen.
Well, I think it takes the adage, it takes a village, and going, okay, well, who's in the village?
Right, yeah.
Exactly. And we don't get to control that, but we do get to be in charge of it. And we need to be bold enough to do what we can to influence and shape the village that they're exposed.
Yeah. We can't stack the deck.
Yeah, you can't stack the deck.
Yeah.
And you can disrupt the village if it doesn't feel like this is an appropriate, or there's enough players in this village that are going to offset, which I think is probably a more reasonable approach. Though it is the personality of some kids that if you like them, they're not going to like them. So it's, you know, I see that tension as well. I want to be, you know, realistic in saying I get to be in charge and I get to influence, but there is so much we're not in control of. And how do we manage that without a whole lot of anxiety? Well, I don't know that it's possible without anxiety, but I don't have to let my anxiety manage me in managing their village, their influences, and the direction they're going in.
That's right. Well, guys, we could go on and on. There might be a part three for this topic. I think we've opened up another can of worms that we need to probably have another episode. And I appreciate you guys and your willingness to chat about this and what it means to talk to our kids about sex and sexuality. I know a lot of dads that listen, and I know they really value your input and guidance in this area in particular, but they also value our prayers. Mm-hmm. And I think our prayers over this topic and over our men and the dads who are listening and the moms too, there might be a single mom or a family out there that happens to click on this and it, you know, to glean some wisdom from you all in this topic. And I'd love to pray over them. And Ron, would you pray for those dads and those families?
Well, and those single moms as well, because, I mean, that's a dynamic we are confronted with a lot. There's not a good masculine voice. And so how can we support, encourage those moms that are trying to do their best to step into the need of that young man? So let me pray. Father God, we know with confidence that you know and are not surprised by anything that occurs in our lives. We know that you have a design for each and for all of us to live out the gift of sexuality, the gift of our masculine or femininity. We also know that you have charged us as parents, both dads and mom, to influence the development of our kids and their understanding of sex, their understanding of their own bodies and their own design, to understand the blessing of sexuality as well as its vulnerabilities. We just ask that you would continue to move for those that call you by name and walk after you faithfully, to give discernment, to give wisdom, to give courage, to lead their kids, to influence their kids in the ways that you would have us walk, and that they would teach, regardless of their past, would teach positive and fruitful understanding of the beauty of sex, the beauty of our sexuality, and the gifts that it offers. And so we commit each dad listening today, we commit each mom listening to this round table, that they may be imbued by your Holy Spirit to walk after you faithfully and to parent after you with their kids faithfully. And we pray this, Jesus, as our first brother, in your precious but powerful name. Before you, Father God, amen.
Amen. Thanks, guys.